Shalom and welcome to the Prophets of Israel Revealed. This is part two on the book of Joshua. This is Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel. Thank you for joining us. We're here in our studios in the Judean Mountains. It's late at night. I'm seeing the lights of literally the entire land of Israel before me. I have Gaza to my left. I have Tel Aviv to my right. I have the Mediterranean Sea, although it's a little bit of a distance. It's right in front of me here from the peaks of the mountains and the hills of Judea. Thank you for joining us. We ended our last half saying that Hashem, in an ideal world, doesn't want to perform miracles for us. And perhaps that's one of the most critical messages that we can see throughout the book of Joshua. But before we get to that, I know that that's shocking because so many people see miracles as an ideal state. Wow, Hashem is performing miracles for us. We're so spiritual. This is exciting. We're experiencing His revelation. We can see Hashem manifest Himself. But the truth is that in an ideal world, Hashem does not want to perform miracles as we understand them. He doesn't want to stop nature and create something different in order to act within nature. But rather, He wants us to realize that nature in and of itself, although it seems automatic, is a miracle. Hashem doesn't need to intervene because He's always intervening. He's always a part. And that miracles, in fact, are a sign that something is off, that we're not yet in an ideal state. But let's keep that in the back of our mind right now. I'd like everyone to kind of listen, think about that, chew on that for a while. We're going to dedicate an entire segment probably just to that idea. But I want to break you into it a little bit slowly because it's so counterintuitive to the way we've understood miracles up until now. But let's move on. What I want to do now is give a little bit of an idea of the proper way to approach the book of Joshua, the proper way to approach Navi Bichlal. I mean, at all, this is, if you want to study the Navi, this is a healthy way to look at it, because you may study the Navi and come to the conclusion that the Jewish people are just a miserable people, that we're a stiff-necked nation, we oppress the poor, we don't keep Shabbat, we're worshiping idols, we don't listen to prophet after prophet after prophet, mistake after mistake after mistake, sin upon sin, evil king. I mean, it's just like you could look at our nation and just think that we are just a despicable, disgusting nation. And the truth is, that is not the right prism through which to understand Tanakh. The stories of Tanakh in particular, they are, in a sense, history, but more than history, they are history as Hashem would like us to see history. And not only that, the emphasis of the historic events that unfold are what Hashem wants us to pay attention to. And what do I mean by that? Let me tell you a quick story. I'm a platoon sergeant in the Israeli Army. Ari's a sharpshooter. We're in the same unit together. And about once a year, we're called up to duty. But before we go into active combat, there's at least, if not more, at least 1 week of training. And within that week of training, sometimes it'll be 2 weeks of training, there will be massive exercises. Exercises that involve hundreds of soldiers, tanks, planes, artillery, foot soldiers, sometimes we'll use the Navy, massive logistics, massive exercises. And after a week, 2 weeks, even a month of this huge exercise, this huge targhil, what happens, and everyone knows this, it's been in the Army, is there's what's called a tachkir, an investigation, a report on what happened during this exercise. They have this investigation, and everything is recorded. It's recorded and it's filed away in the files of the Army so future officers can read the reports and learn from the exercises that happen. But let me tell you that if an officer 500 years from now looks back at the Israeli Army's files today, at these exercises, he will absolutely think that the Israeli Army is a bumbling mishap, mistaken, just like, how did they win any wars? I mean, they're just saturated. All these files, it's just mistake after mistake after mistake after fumble after miscommunication, mistake after mistake. And this guy shot his own person. I mean, it's just like it's overwhelming. If someone would think that the Israeli army is totally incompetent. Obviously, the Israeli army is not incompetent. What's happening? These investigations are here, were created for us to learn from. No one needs to know if someone did something right. No one needs to know, oh, this person, let me tell you, he was really fast and he ran really well. And this person shot just right. That's not helping anyone. These investigations are there to unsurface the mistakes that the soldiers, that the officers made in the exercise in order that future generations of officers will be able to look at their mistakes and say, ah, he really made a tactical error in the decision that he made to take that mountain from the east. Really, he should have waited for the sunlight and then taken it from the west. And then, I mean, we're there to learn from it. That is the secret of Tanakh. It was given to us for every generation for us to learn from. So the emphasis very often is on the mistakes of the Jewish people. We don't necessarily need to know that the Jewish people lived in Israel and they kept Shabbat and they were kind to their fellow man and they gave tzedakah and they were good folks. There's nothing to learn from. The Tanakh brings us the mistakes, the downfalls, the corruption, the oppression, in order that every generation afterwards would be able to look at the Tanakh and realize what mistakes were made then, in order that when we return to the land of Israel after our bitter exile, we won't make the same mistakes that the nation did when they entered the land in the time of Yahushua. That we won't make the same mistakes that we made when we entered the land in the time of Ezra. Every single one of these prophetic stories is here to help us see the pitfalls that knocked them off their feet, that we wouldn't fall. That is the reason why so many of the prophetic messages within the Tanakh are negative. Now, someone takes that as objective history is just mistaken. It's objective history in the fact that it's Hashem's view, but it's Hashem's view of how he wants us to experience and learn from our history. So now, with that background, we're going to delve into the book of Yahushua. Now, first, we need to know who was this man, Yahushua. So, the best place to start, in my opinion, would be in the book of Deuteronomy, in chapter 18. In verse 15, Hashem says, "A prophet from your midst, from your brethren, like me, shall Hashem your God establish for you. To him shall you hearken." Moshe tells the nation, "A prophet from among you, from your brethren, like me, like Moses, Hashem will establish for you, and to him you shall hearken." Then Hashem said to me, "They have done well in what they have said. I will establish a prophet for them from among their brethren like you, and I will place my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them everything that I will command him." Now, these verses right here are somewhat controversial. They're controversial in the sense that every other world religion has taken these verses and they've attached it to their religion. The Muslims say that it's Muhammad. Christians very often say that it's talking about Jesus. And within the context of the Torah, within the chronology of the Torah, within the history of the Torah, there is no question that this is talking about Yahushua, a prophet like Moshe, not a God manifested in human form, not a man, an Arabia thousands of years later. We're talking about right now, Moses is speaking to the nation of Israel and saying, "I'm going to die very soon. Hashem is choosing a prophet like me that is going to take you into the land of Israel." And we open up to the end of the book of Deuteronomy. What do we see? This is chapter 34. Chapter 34 at the very end. Here it says, Moshe dies. This is verse 7, chapter 34. Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes had not dimmed, and his vigor had not diminished. The children of Israel bewailed Moshe in the plains of Moab for 30 days. Then the days of tearful mourning for Moses ended. Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom because Moses had laid his hands upon him. So the children of Israel obeyed him and did as Hashem had commanded Moses. So here we see, chapter 18, Moshe says, a new leader is going to arise, like me. He's going to take you into the land of Israel. The Jewish people see Moshe take his hands and give smicha to Joshua. He literally ordains him as the new leader, anoints him in many ways as the king of that time, the king of the nation, and says, you are going to be blessed with the spirit of wisdom. You are going to be the representative of Hashem to this people. The people see this happening. They hear Moshe saying a new leader is going to arise. They see Moshe give Yehoshua his blessing, and Yehoshua then takes the lead. Now, from the very end of Deuteronomy, it's such a natural flow into the very beginning of the book of Yehoshua. And then what happens? The book of Yehoshua starts with the very first verse. It happened after the death of Moses, servant of Hashem, that Hashem said to Yehoshua, Bin Nun, Moses' attendant, Moses, my servant, has died. Now arise, cross this Jordan, you and this entire people, to the land that I give to them, to the children of Israel. Every place upon which the sole of your foot will tread, I have given to you as I have spoken to Moses. It's such a natural continuum. He was the continuation for the Jewish people. He was the very next leader. So we now realize Moshe was chosen to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt until the border. Hashem brings Moshe to the mountains of Moab, which are right across from the Dead Sea. Above Edom, but right in the center there of the Dead Sea where the mountains of Moab are. He looks over into the land of Israel, and Hashem says to him, literally, you can look, but you can't touch. Your job is done. And I'm going to take Yehoshua, and he is going to be the leader that brings the Jewish people into the land of Israel. Now that in and of itself is such a powerful message of Judaism. Folks, listen to me. The Western world is all about goals. You look at every single solitary life coach, a self-help book. It's all about defining goals, accomplishing goals, setting to-do lists, making it happen. Judaism teaches it's not about the goal or the destination. It's only about the journey. Moshe was chosen in the book of Shemot in chapter 3 to bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, to bring them into the land of milk and honey. Does he do it? He actually doesn't accomplish his goal. He gets them almost there, and as he's about to accomplish his life's mission that he was chosen for, his time comes to an end, and Yehoshua takes control. Yehoshua then is literally the king of Israel at that time. He's bringing the Jewish people into the land of Israel, and his goal is to conquer the land and to inherit it to the Jewish people and to establish a peaceful kingdom. But Joshua doesn't complete his goal either. We look at David. David was chosen as the Davidic dynasty, Mashiach, to build the temple, to establish a house of prayer for all nations, to usher in the Messianic era. David prepares everything to build the temple, but he doesn't get to build it. Every single leader in Israel is brought up to a test to accomplish his goal. And right before the goal is about to be accomplished, Hashem says, your time is up. I want you to know, it wasn't about the goal. It was always about the journey. And that is the first message of the book of Yehoshua, that we as people are so concerned about living for the next element. We're trained as little children. We have to do good in first grade for second grade, and we have to do good in grade school to get into a good high school. We have to do good in high school because we want to get into college. And oh, goodness, you better do good in college if you want to get into a graduate program. And oh, the graduate program, then you really got to do well, because then you're going to have to get an internship at a law firm. And if you're an internship at a law firm, you better prove yourself, because only 2 out of 5 are going to get accepted to the law firm. And then once you're in the law firm, oh, now I really have to work, because then I'm going to get promoted. And your entire life has passed, and you keep on working towards a goal that is never actually there. And what you've missed isn't just the journey, you've missed your life because you've always been working towards a goal of something else. The first message of the book of Yahushua, passing from Moshe to Yahushua, is, folks, don't worry about the diploma. Don't worry about the promotion. Worry about today. This is where Hashem put us. Zehayom asa Hashem nagila v'nismecha bo. It's this day that Hashem created. Let us rejoice and be happy in it. It is the journey and not the destination and not the to-do list and not the goal. It's how we accomplish those goals that counts. Are we doing it happy? Are we doing it with integrity? Are we doing it side by side with Hashem? That's the first, I believe, the first and most powerful message, just the transition we see it happening right here. So now I want to talk a little bit of an overview about the book of Yahushua. It's important when we go into this, for those of you that have never studied the book of Yahushua, it's critical if before we really delve into it, what I'd like to do now is sort of take a bird's eye view of the book of Yahushua, kind of go through the entire book. And then once we see the entire picture, we see the map, we see the end game, we see the structure of the book, we can then go piece by piece and start taking it apart. But first, it's healthy and good to actually just read through the book of Yahushua. Don't get caught up in details. Don't get caught up in commentaries. Just read the story from chapter 1 to chapter 24 and get an overview. In Hebrew, we would call it bikiut, just a shitchi, a shallow knowledge, just so we know the book in its entirety. Because very often, we'll see that there are patterns and structures within the book that if we study it chapter by chapter, story by story, we won't see the messages that are being revealed to us that can only be revealed to us through a bird's eye view. So in order to help us on that journey, what I'd like to do now is to just take the book apart from an aerial perspective. And this is how the book of Joshua is divided. And this is how it works. The book of Joshua is divided into two halves. Now, this is critical to know. The two halves, in this case, actually work out quite remarkably. There's 24 chapters. The first half is chapter 1 to chapter 12. And the second half is chapter 13 to chapter 24. It's exactly half and half. But know that the chapter and verse in the Tanakh has absolutely no holiness to it. It was some English bishop in the 1500s that, in his own mind, decided that it was important just for technical reasons that we would know how to reference to the Tanakh. The Jewish people, we had Sof Pasuk. We knew when the end of a passage was. We had our own interpretations as far as parshias. There would be open parshias and closed parshias when we write the scroll. But sometimes, you know, a huge section would go by and we never actually used a numbering system to say chapter 1, verse 7. It was just never there. So this English bishop created this system. Now, sometimes the system, he actually does a pretty good job. But very often, not only does he do a terrible job, he has an agenda while he's dividing the chapters, and he cuts off an issue right in the middle of something in order to emphasize how bad the Jewish people were, as an example, because he came from a replacement theology Christian perspective that wanted to diminish and just embarrass the Jews as a rejected nation. So it's important that although we'll use chapter and verse, there is nothing really to be learned from this division because there's nothing divine about it. It has nothing in Jewish tradition. And in a way, it sort of kind of just becomes sanctified by the Jewish people accepting it as it is. But the book of Joshua that we've discussed is broken into two halves, 1 to 12 and 13 to 24. It's the first 12 chapters are talking about Kibush Haaretz, conquering the land of Israel. And chapters 13 to 24 are talking about chapters of inheriting the land of Israel. And just knowing that alone solves a lot of problems. Here's a great example. You look at the end of chapter 12, And it says that Joshua conquered the entire land of Israel, destroyed everyone, and had these amazing victories. And then we look at chapter 13, and all of a sudden it says, well, Joshua was old and well on in years. This is the first verse in the book of Joshua in chapter 13. Joshua was old, well on in years, and Hashem said to him, you have grown old, you are well on in years, and very much land still remains to be possessed. But just a second ago, in the end of chapter 12, we're saying that Joshua just demolished the enemy, and there's no one that was left. And here in chapter 13, we're stuck saying there's a lot more to be inherited. So what do we have here? Ah, here's the answer. Chazal say that the time of Joshua was divided into seven-year periods. The first 7 years was the 7 years of conquering. The last 7 years were 7 years of nachala, of inheriting. Now, we know this very well. In the Six-Day War, the Jewish people just demolished four armies. We left nothing of them. We destroyed their air forces and their tanks, and we just crushed them. But inheriting the land of Israel from the Arabs that are still within the land is a whole other story. So here we have the first 12 chapters of the book of Joshua are teaching us the secrets, the pitfalls, the inspiration of how we are to conquer and take possession of the land of Israel. And we have the last half of the book of Joshua from chapter 13 to chapter 24 talking about Parashot Hitnachalut, the parshas of inheriting the land of Israel. And here we start. We will go into, at the very next half, the first four chapters of the book of Joshua. And that is entering into the land of Israel and crossing the Jordan. There are so many secrets that are still left to be revealed, but I want you to keep this one in mind. Hashem, in an ideal world, does not want to perform manifest miracles as we understand them. And that is going to be clarified in the very next half. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Rabbi Jeremy Gimpel, and we are now ending the second part of our series in the book of Joshua and the prophets of Israel revealed. Shalom from the mountains of Judea.